Who wants to say something? Seth?
I think I've pointed the question. You make this point about how formal logic says that the passiveness of the knower, that the knower, when you observe something, you know how you interact on it. And that's a big problem in psychology, that recently with the application of some new insights, they began to realize that the guy who's making the experiment has a profound effect on what he's studying. Until they realize what they're doing now is they're going to throw out about 80% of their results in experimental and social psychology. They're thinking they're not right and left because it's all useless. But the question I have is a point you made that I didn't understand at all. This was about in formal logic, the actions, your actions cannot have the results that you wanted it to. That your actions cannot have the desired results because if it did, and then it would be doing the thing that you wanted it to.
Oh, you mean connection with Hegel?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Kind of, like the existentialist thought, well, another way
has
the same idea. I didn't
understand the point. Well, that's where so far as the existentialists talk like that, that's where they got it from, to some extent. See, it's just this, that for Hegel, the objective reason, this, what, look, we can put it this way. If it weren't for the fact that, say, in a capitalist society, every individual, or most individuals, you know, are subjected to the vicissitudes of the economic system. That is, the laws of the capitalist economy confront him as an objective law, right? That he just has to adjust himself to somehow. If it were not that way, then in fact it wouldn't be capitalist. I mean, in a socialist society, you don't have that. You have a control by the associated individuals over the economic system. Now, for Hegel, a defining characteristic of objective reason is precisely that it stands over against the individuals in the long run, in a certain sense, you see this notion of reason in history, using the individuals, contrary to the individual's own wishes and passions, for the realization of this reason. Now see, this is modeled exactly on the operation of the economic laws in a capitalist society. So, if it ever happened, that an individual's wishes and desires coincided with the necessity of history consciously, then this distinction would be destroyed. This distinction would be broken down. But for Hegel, it can't be. The only way this distinction can be broken down, you see, is through the knower knowing that this is the case. So that Hegel knows that Napoleon wanted one thing, but what actually happened in the cunning of reason was the establishment of, you know, bourgeois society and so forth and so on, which Napoleon couldn't care less about, right? And spirit and all that, the realization of spirit. So Hegel knows this, but if you know it, then you are reconciled to it. For Hegel, if you realize that there is an objective reason, and that whatever happens to me as an individual and the frustration of my wishes and so forth and so on is an inherent and necessary part of the realization of this reason, then I cannot want to change it. Only he who does not know can want to act. So that, on the one hand, we have Hegel, who understands everything and can't do anything, and on the other hand, we have Napoleon, who understands nothing, but in this sense, you see, and who is the agent, who is the completer of world history, who brings into being that which the whole history of being has been straining for. So it's an odd position to be in. You see, so Hegel... for both of them, but especially, I think, for Hegel, because, see, Napoleon didn't know it. does that make it clear what the argument was?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think many people call the Marxist dialectic a very term to pronounce any very new piece of synthesis, and the Marxist dialectic is a first innovation and the nature of innovation. Now, when you go into the difference, what is Marx do? How do you get from what's the difference between the synthesis?
Well, in the first place, people who talk about Hegel in terms of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis don't know anything about Hegel. Hegel uses those terms together exactly once, and that once he uses it to accuse Fichte of having mechanistically established a threefold schema of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And you see, in the same thing in formulas like position, negation, and negation of the negation. have the same kind of quality to them. They're not altogether false, of course. There's a, in you see, there's a kind of rhythm in wherever you find contradiction. Obviously, in some sense, wherever there's contradiction, there's a battle going on, a struggle. There are two terms. One you can call a thesis, and the other the antithesis. And if there's a temporal relation involved, which in reality there always is, then the prior, the first one, or the less developed one in some sense, is naturally the thesis, that which is posited, and the antithesis is that which is opposed to it. And then if somehow or another there's a resolution of this conflict, the production of some new state, in some sense or another, that will be a synthesis. Whether you call that a synthesis or a negation of the negation doesn't make too much difference. In both of these formulas, though, the important thing is that they have to be simply theoretical guides. That is to say, that class society is a negation, primitive society, and socialism is the negation of the negation, that is a negation of class society, isn't really to say anything in particular. Now, it's not useless, though, you see. What it is it points, it tells you to start undertaking concrete researches. Look, it tells you what to look for. Look for how primitive communism or primitive communalism turned into class society. That is, look for the mechanisms whereby classes arose. And most importantly of all, of course, you know, so in other words, you have to start writing and understanding all of history. And then you have to start investigating. Well, it is a guideline to the understanding of capitalism. How does capitalism turn into socialism? How is the negation negated? Now, usually when this thing in Hegel is counterposed, what's being referred to, I think, is exactly this point, that in a sense for Hegel, because ultimately, somehow, at bottom, you see, there's a dialectic is a pure logical relation, a pure ideational relation, before it's a temporal relation. In some sense, for Hegel, the contradictories, the elements that are in struggle, are always preserved, are eternally preserved. The unification of opposites is something that, you see, sort of happens superimposed on top of the preservation of the same. And this is whereas, of course, in Marx, where you have where temporality is the basic constituent of reality, then all this stuff is played out in time, so that plenty of things can disappear. I mean, for Marx, there's no sense, in saying that in any sense whatever, say, feudalism is preserved in a socialist society. The acquisitions and achievements and so on of feudalism are preserved, but feudalism is not preserved in any sense whatsoever. Yeah?
The reason I brought this up is the many sadly, quote unquote, dialecticians have done exactly what you explained in Hegelian dialectic does. They claim that their transitional society is actually socialism.
That's right.
It's a physicist. And they have denied, I think, the subtle but important distinction between a synthesis
as
final result and a negation of
negation. All right, yeah, in this sense, I think this is very true, of course. Sure, yeah.
You mentioned in your talk that anti-Marxists often accuse dialectics to be metaphysical or something like that. What's the basis of that sort of thing?
Well, it depends on what side it comes from. Yeah, okay, I'll say what the, there are a lot of bases of it. You see, if you define as metaphysics anything that cannot be confirmed by the kind of operations that you have from the outset decided to be permissible, then in fact, you see, dialectics is metaphysics. In other words, if you say A equals A, and any assertion, and this is the principle, this is a basic test that any proposition has to pass. If it asserts anything, or it can be deduced from it, anything contrary to that, then we say it's in a strict sense a meaningless proposition. But the second step in the syllogism is meaningless propositions nevertheless mean something to people. and this is what metaphysics is. You see, this was the whole development of logical positivism. Metaphysics are precisely those propositions that don't mean anything, but for some reason people have been concerned with. And your criterion of meaning, as I say, is pre-established. If that criterion is a formal logical one, which it always is, then since metaphysics violates that criterion, it's meaningless. It's important to some people, therefore it's metaphysics. This is really the logic of it. The second, of course, sort of a historical reason is simply that it was developed by philosophers. That is, metaphysics was born in philosophy. I mean, the dialectics was naturally formulated within the metaphysical tradition. The people that formulated it, certainly Hegel and, of course, Marx and Engels, happened to be literate, cultivated people who were conscious of their past. Therefore, they were aware of their relation to the philosophical tradition, which was a very complex one, both positive and negative. To a very large extent, those who, call dialectics metaphysics are unaware of their relation to the philosophical tradition, either because they're ignoramuses or because they have consciously rejected any tie. And therefore, any tradition that does retain some consciousness of a connection to a philosophical tradition appears to them metaphysical. Apropos, there's a remark that Engels someplace makes, and he's talking about the kind of late 19th century mechanistic materialists or positivists, people like Haeckel and Mochel, who, of course, Engels regarded with absolute contempt. And he was discussing the question of why a scientist, why a good materialist scientist, I think he makes the same point in Annie Deering, should study philosophy. And he says very simply, because if you don't, you're going to fall a victim to the bad philosophies and the obsolete philosophies of the past. Jim?
I'd like you to, if you could, go over again with illustration the point that I think is confusing to many people. On the one hand, you're talking about formal logic, A equals A, and, all of us have that kind of common sense background that, something is what it is. And then all of a sudden, through criticism of this, you show that it's equally true to say A is non-A. And I look and see people sort of blink and so on, because it really, I don't think, is clear. How can both statements, in a sense, be true? In other words, there must be a sense in which A is non-A is also false. Because things are distinct.
Like I said, if I abstract from time, if I abstract from history, if I abstract from time, what were all the other things? Yeah. I abstract from interaction. If I abstract from sensation, if I abstract from matter, if I confine myself to the immanence, the pure immanence of pure ideas, and lift it out of the real stream of consciousness, then of course formal logic calls. Except that you can't say anything then. I'm serious. So far as you can make these abstractions, and so far as knowledge can be organized usefully with respect to these abstractions, and formal logic is perfectly valid. Obviously, you can't talk without observing the rules of formal logic intelligibly. I mean, much of Alice in Wonderland is, of course, an experiment in suspending, not just restricting, but suspending one after another various elements of formal logic to see what happens. And in many ways, it's much more like the real world than it's true than.
That point where you're saying that this is a table, and you begin, I think it's the kind of thing that Hegel does, showing that once you start talking about the various qualities of that object, it is not any one of these qualities.
That's right.
So then you begin to...
It's not any one of those qualities. It's not any of those qualities together. It's not the either the togetherness. It's not the totality of the qualities, nor is it the togetherness itself. What is it?
I don't know.
All right. Okay, yeah. Yeah,
you put in Parsons as an example of modern social science being static and concerned with problems of equilibrium and abstracting from any kind of conception of society being developmental dynamic in any way. And you pointed them out also as an example of an obsession with stability. On the other hand, it is possible to find in a considerable amount of modern social science and economics, for example, dynamic analysis and analysis of problems of instability using mathematical techniques that are based in formal logic. And I was wondering how you considered that type of methodology and how you think it's marked off from, say, an alternative dynamic theory as is Marxism. What are the essential differences? Because I think, you know, that modern social science can produce dynamic theory and theory concerning stability.
It can produce, I don't know who you're talking about. In the first place, I don't think this has anything to do with the use of mathematical techniques. That is, I don't think the question of how far you can quantify it or what kinds of, or how far you can, for whatever reason, formalize certain parts of a model is not really relevant. At least I don't think it is. Secondly, of course, even structure function theories can be dynamized. I mean, Parsons doesn't exclude a certain kind of change. It certainly doesn't exclude the kind of therapeutic change associated with the clearing up of dysfunctions, and it doesn't even, at least you can dynamize that. That is, you can have a moving equilibrium, kind of a constantly reestablished homeostasis, disrupted and reestablishment of it. But I'm sure there's a lot of modern bourgeois social theory that I don't know, but it seems to me that the stuff, for example, in someone like Dahrendorf, where again, you get you start out with an emphasis on conflict, on an attempt to develop a general theory of social class. But by the end, at the end, you seem to me to end up with anything very different from what you get in Parsons. That is the assumption that the integrative function of class conflict is its social reality. At least in modern society. Now, I think this is based on the methodological presuppositions. I don't know. See, who are you talking about specifically? And again, it's very likely stuff I don't know because I just don't know that much about modern
point,
theory.
Much point in that. I was just saying that using much the same techniques as are used in analysis of stable situations of equilibrium.
Yeah.
You can produce models and systems that show systems fundamentally unstable.
Sure. This is true.
There's nothing essentially undynamic or non-developmental or non-conflict about the kind of method upon which bourgeois social science is based.
Well, except we'll see. You see, I think there is. That is, I'm willing to make this an empirical statement that if you look at the history of bourgeois theory, then the conflict models have. I mean, they've turned up time and time again, and they have always and again very quickly been subsumed mm-hmm. under some kind of harmonistic theorizing. See what I mean? Now, I think this is an empirical fact. And it's this that's characteristic. It's this that I was trying to, get hold of, to trace in the ideology itself of bourgeois society, which is what shapes the method. Not whether or not there's a possibility of building conflict models and of communicating them intelligibly. I think Marxism is this in a certain sense. And certainly individual thinkers have done it here or there. I don't know if that... Yeah?
Yeah, I was commenting on the question. First of all, I think that... it's a mistake, really, to say that mathematics is based on logic. This has been the program of mathematicians since the 1890s, the beginning of the work of men like Frege and Peano, to make the structure of mathematics that had begun with Newton and Leibniz and the invention of the calculus, and the whole working out of mathematical physics, to work out this structural framework on an axiomatic basis and on the basis of formal logic. This program has not been completed yet. See, the development of mathematics towards formal thinking developed out of harmonic analysis and moved backwards in the direction of the foundations of mathematics. In other words, it's not true that mathematics started out with certain axioms and then just developed out of that. That's the program for pedagogically reproducing the development of mathematics. The actual historical development of mathematics is out of the calculus, backward in the direction of the foundation, to try and clear up certain inconsistencies that had appeared in the calculus that they couldn't handle, that led backwards into what's now known as the foundations crisis in mathematics. And this, you know, while this program has produced a lot of new results, and the axiomatic method has proved to be an enormous tool in mathematics, they still haven't completely solved the problem of developing mathematics within the framework of formal logic. They can't do it without drastically altering the whole mechanism of formal logic in such a way that it becomes completely artificial. For example, they'll start out with sets that build themselves out of nothing, and it becomes very involved and very artificial, and loses all its naturalness once you try to actually achieve it. However, ideologically, this is what the mathematicians believe. Mathematicians have a very low level of historical consciousness of their own science. It's only very recently that the study of the history of mathematics is becoming a recognized academic discipline. Then with respect to the dynamic theories in economics, in Ernest Mandel's book, he points out that one of the main sources of the dynamic theory, the dynamic model that the capitalist economists are using now, are variants of the concepts that are implicit in the works of Marx, that they really haven't developed these on their own. These are mathematical models based on this. And their main theoretical, the dynamic models of capitalism are restricted primarily to mathematical economics. They don't appear in a theoretical development of the subject. They still talk in terms of equilibrium. An equilibrium theory has to always account for the shifting of the equilibrium, not from within the system itself, which would be a dialectical explanation of what was happening, but due to some, cosmic forces bombing in from the outside, or, and they could be a number of things, perhaps wars, for example, which they don't see as necessarily stemming out of the development of the social system as a whole, but which appear at a propitious moment so that they can invest. Or, I think that it's fundamentally correct to say that they don't have this. For example, in social theory or in anthropology, they're just the beginning of the effort to dynamize just a few efforts. See, the idea is that the real structure of society is the roles that people have, the things the way that they are supposed to interrelate, the things that govern how they interrelate according to things that are going on inside their head. But it doesn't take into account the fact that once people act on these roles, they begin to dynamically change the environment that they're in. For example, there was a study of the kinship system
of an Indian tribe that can mathematically. This was a step for dialectic in the sense that they found that if the various kinship groups kept marrying according to their marriage laws and so on, that the size of the different kinship groups would change. That one group would expand until finally it was the only kinship group, and then they couldn't marry anyone else. So that eventually a situation was going to arise that because acting on these roles, they were going to change the population dynamics that would flow from these roles, would create a situation where they would have to change their marriage laws.
I think we better go on and see if someone else has something to say, okay, for a while. Has anyone else got... How formal logicians explain minor changes? They ignore them. I mean, there isn't change. It's not, you don't see, within the framework of formal logic, you don't try to explain exactly anything. What I tried to suggest here is that the kind of mind, the kind of ideology that finds its expression in formal logic, or the limitation of logic to formal logic, entails, one way or another, the denial of change. Now, with informal logic itself, you simply don't talk about change.
In other words, well, what would they do with history? Right?
With what?
History.
Well... there are a number of, as far as history is concerned, there have been a number of contradictory responses of what I call formal thinking or metaphysical thinking to history. Either you dissolve history into a discrete set of occurrences, you know, the unique event. Every event is absolutely unique, and then the task of the science of history becomes simply as precise a description as possible of each event, or on a somewhat higher level, you try to do that with, say, groups, historical time sequences, you call civilizations or something. You try to define the spirit or the soul of a particular civilization as precisely as possible. Or else you try to develop a classical philosophy of history, let's call it, in which there's some postulated purpose or goal, some inner essence of history that's expressing itself in all of the particular historical occurrences, and then you simply use the occurrences as kind of the occasion, you see, the occasion of the expression of this this principle. You see what I mean? In other words, in every case of this sort, one way or another, the reality of change, the reality of history itself, is lost from view. In one case, either by dissolving history into these discrete chunks, which is sort of comparable, in the social sciences of comparative statics, you investigate this and you investigate this and you investigate this, and the question of how you get from here to there is not permitted to arise in a theoretical way, or else you postulate or somehow work with the assumption that there is some supra-historical being who is simply expressing itself or himself in each concrete event, and again, the reality of history has been dissipated. But both of those are perfectly consistent with quite consistent with what I'd call the formal logical attitude. Okay, well, finally, ultimately, Hegel ends up doing that, you see. Hegel ends up with this it's very tricky, hard to talk about Hegel, because almost anything, okay, I'll make the flat accusation that Hegel remained in fact a theologian, that much as he in one way didn't want to and can be interpreted as a thoroughgoing atheist, he in reality wasn't. That this world spirit is not just a metaphor for Hegel, but refers to a subsistent reality that is trans-historical and only unfolds itself, only exposes itself, you see, in history. And so then what you do is you try to look at all history, the unique phenomenon. See, then you ask, for example, what was the meaning of Alexander's life, or of Caesar's life, or of Napoleon's life for the showing forth of the world spirit, for the realization of reason in the world? The most recent example of this kind of historiography, this kind of historiography usually has the advantage, you know, that it takes big chunks. I mean, they're not pedants. These are people that want to write universal history. But Toynbee is an example in the recent years of this kind of historiography. Yeah? I'm sorry, could you speak a little louder? I can't.
What's your opinion on the, you know, current issue after the possibility of a dichotomy between Marxist own view on dialectics and Hegel? In other words, you know, there's a big debate now that the, you know, dialectical materialism is really Hegel's own, you know, invention, and Marx wouldn't agree with him, and that Marx was essentially a rebellion and concerned with alienation, supposed to.
Right. Well, I think it's largely nonsense. I mean, you know, you can. It's a good game. Let's see. You can get the young Marx and the old Marx and the young Hegel and the old Marx, and you can play the old Engels and the old Engels. Well, okay, you can play the old Engels off against the young Marx, the old Marx off against the young Engels. Althusser, for example, in Marx himself, has no less than four or five now distinct Marxes. I mean, there's a methodological question here. Once you start, you know, there's no limit to how far you can dissolve a man's biography, a thinker's biography, for the very simple reason that people change. And ideas, I mean, even an individual, even if it in some sense is true that every genius has only one idea, it undergoes development. Now, there obviously is a big difference between the 1844 or 45 manuscripts of Marx and the last letters that Engels wrote. One difference is 50 years. Now, against the just from a, you know, empirical, external, biographical point of view, against the attempt to play Engels off against Marx is the fact that the most offending work of Engels in this respect, well, one of the two most offending works of Engels in this respect, is the Anti-Düring. But it also is the case that Marx wrote two chapters of it and read the whole thing. And if he had violently disagreed with it, he presumably would have said something about it to Engels. There obviously is a lot of difference in emphasis, and a very careful and unprejudiced text analysis of everything that both men wrote, I am sure, could work out some quite fundamental differences of a certain sort, at least differences in style and temperament, which, of course, they were. They were utterly different in style and temperament and so forth, which will manifest themselves in the direction of thought. But I've never seen anyone that's able to build a convincing case that there is any kind of fundamental theoretical divergence between Marx and Engels. Now, there's several things involved in this, but one of the things that's involved in this is that it is quite true, of course, that for a number of reasons, with the development of, well, first of all, with the development of reformism, or a kind of hidden reformism, in the Second International, the kind of centrist reformism, finally represented by Kautsky and people like that, and secondly, and for somewhat the same reasons, with the development of Stalinism, there was an immense tendency to try to read all of Marxian Engels' theory from the standpoint of the philosophy of nature. And there's an obvious reason for this. That is one thing that it is true that here you did get the development, you see, of an objectivistic, mechanistic in connection with reformism, because this is what you have to have in order to manipulate and adjust the machine and keep it running, sort of an earlier Parsonianism that arose within the Marxist tradition. from the standpoint of Stalinism, you have to be able to do the same thing, ultimately, to justify the usurpation, the political usurpation by the bureaucracy. So you do get a, you know, this objectivistic, mechanistic interpretation of Marxism. And the starting point for that, quite naturally, is going to be the philosophy of nature. And the starting point of that, since Engels happened to be interested in it, is going to be Engels. But the tendency then to conclude back that Engels was therefore some kind of a crypto-Stalinist. this is what is often involved, I think, in the argument, is a formal logical fallacy. And then, of course, that's what I think about it at this point. Yeah?